Welcome back to the latest edition of In Play Podcast, the official podcast of Beyond the Box Score. I am your host, Evan Davis, joined by the belated birthday boy, Nick Cellini. Nick, what's up?
Hi, Evan. How are you? Have you recovered from our little binge from the other night?
I mean, I don't believe I was the one who was binging on anything. Happy
drink
birthday
in moderation,
to you,
sir. Kids. Drink in moderation.
Happy birthday to you, my dude. Do you feel any older, any wiser?
I feel like a proper Methuselah.
There we go. Very happy to be back. We took Memorial Day weekend off, and a great deal has happened in the interim. Namely, Mike Trout's gone for 2 months, and Bryce Harper was gone for 3 games. Do we need to focus on any of these pertinent issues other than the fact that a world without Mike Trout is a very sad world indeed?
Yeah, I mean, I'm sure everybody knows about the Trout thing at this point. He hurt his thumb. He's gone for 2 months. All meaning is gone from the world. But other than that, we're fine. In terms of Bryce Harper, he just... To co-opt his wonderful philosophy, there's no participation trophy for a bad helmet throw. You have to do it properly for recognition, and if you don't, you suck, and it's bad.
I think that if you haven't read Sam Miller's article in ESPN on what the real crime Bryce Harper committed was on that fateful Monday afternoon, go read that toot suite. Basically, Bryce Harper, don't pick a fight if it's going to make you look stupid. We actually got some mailbag questions this week. Very excited. We've been really looking forward to doing one of these shows. We haven't done one in a really long time. And in the future, if you do have any questions for us, tweet us at InPlayPodcast or email us at InPlayPodcast@gmail.com.
Nick, or just blow up Evan in my mentions. It's just any way you want to get the questions through, go for it.
Yeah, please do. So we've got a few here that we're going to tackle. Nick, you want to go ahead and start banging some of these out? These are some actually really interesting and exciting questions, I think.
Okay, we'll start with something that's topical. It's a hot button topic. I don't want to call it an issue. It's a point of discussion that is relevant to our brand, I guess. At DJ MOSFET on Twitter, who is a wise and good person, follow him. He asks if the launch angles were hyped as a cure-all, or if it's being too much is being made out of it. Is it a mountain out of a molehill? Because there was a column in ESPN today by Buster Olney talking about whether or not the launch angle obsession is helping or hurting hitters. There's been some discourse on Twitter, as there usually is. It's been a popular subject at Fangraphs and other analytics sites. So basically, what's in my best Jerry Seinfeld impression? What's the deal with launch angles? And are they in fact hashtag good?
I think in the aggregate, it would be difficult to argue that hitting the ball at 20 degrees is better than hitting the ball at 3 degrees, right? As a rule of thumb, if you're getting the ball in the air, you have the potential to do damage versus shooting it into the ground. Rob Arthur did some research on this topic over at 538, and Joey Votto has actually given a range of quotes as to the efficacy of changing your launch angle. But I think that, I mean, what we're kind of discovering, right, is that you need to find the right kind of range of launch angles for you. It's not a one-size-fits-all thing. You can't all of a sudden do what Yonder Alonso did this year and double your average launch angle and then become a potential superstar. You might also turn into Ryan Schimpf and just hit a bunch of lazy fly balls and pop-ups. I mean, that seems to be my general kind of feeling about this research. I mean, do you have any pushback on that?
No, I mean, it really depends on who you are, right? Like,
Yeah.
See, like, I don't think it's a one-size-fits-all solution. Like you said, you have to find the proper angle at which to smack the ball. But also, I mean, it depends on who you physically are. If you're Ben Revere, hitting a lot of high launch angle pop-ups is probably not going to work because you don't have the physical power. I mean, and Ben Revere's lack of power could be in part due to the fact that he's a flat swing or whatever, but so maybe some swing adjustments could help him tap into whatever nascent power is lurking inside of his wiry frame. But it depends on who you are and where you play. Because like now that Ben Revere is like Ben Revere is an Angel this year, right?
Yes.
So that's a big park. It's a pitcher's park, and Ben Revere doesn't have a whole lot of power to start with. So I don't think Ben Revere trying to hit the ball in the air as much as possible would be good for him because he doesn't have power. You can't just magically turn into a 20 home run hitter by hitting more fly balls. It's not a one size fits all solution. But I think that it's been shown to work, but I also think that we can't view it as the answer because all capital letters answer. Because baseball's a funky sport and you have to do a lot of different things to be good at baseball, and you could take different approaches to being good at baseball. Do I think it's been hyped as a cure-all? I'm not going to say it was hyped as a cure-all, but we've definitely seen a lot of discussion of it this year for various reasons, and I think that between that and the omnipresence of StatCast at this point, I think it's definitely become a thing. And if you listen to our episode with Rob Arthur, the aforementioned Rob Arthur, if you haven't, please go back and listen to it. It was possibly the best episode we've ever done. There are some real issues with the readings on StatCast, and so maybe we're misreading the proper launch angle that you need to achieve to tap into this. There's a lot that goes into this. It depends on who you are physically, whether or not we're getting the right readings to find the optimal angles, and also like where you play half your games, because it's easier to do this if you play in Yankee Stadium than it is if you play in Oakland or if you play in Petco Park.
Well, so I think you hit it pretty spot on in that, like, just the prevalence of StatCast is helping to open up the discourse on this kind of thing, especially among players, right? Like, I remember reading last year that, you know, the fact that exit velocity was now being put up on scoreboards after a ball was hit was allowing players to see how hard they were hitting the ball, and therefore they could, like, joke with each other about who was hitting the ball harder than another guy. The, like, this kind of data being in the public space in a way that it's never been before makes players be more aware of it and therefore think about the ways in which the changes in that data for their own player profile can help them or hurt them, right? So they know that Daniel Murphy increased his average launch angle toward the end of 2015, and we've seen what happens to him. You know, again, Yonder Alonso is obviously a huge outlier here, but I mean, he is incredible all of a sudden. Right. Same thing with Ryan Zimmerman. Same thing with Francisco Lindor. Like, these guys are managing to make it work for them. So I think a lot of guys are probably thinking, well, why not me? Whereas maybe even 10 years ago, this data being less public would not necessarily make players kind of reckon with it in the same way.
Yeah, and I don't, like, Buster Olney's comment he wrote, like, it generated some discussion. And I don't know if everything he wrote here is correct, with all due respect to Buster. But, I mean, I don't think he's necessarily entirely wrong either. Like, there is definitely a happy medium here. And I think that, you know, it really, again, it depends on who you are. I do not think it is a one size fits all solution to people's offensive woes, because and the thing is, like, you can't just like say, okay, I'm gonna put the ball in the air more, because you have to do it correctly. If you don't do it wrong, you're just hitting pop ups and fly balls to the warning track. Like, so yeah, you have to be able to manipulate your bat very well, and you have to be able to have the strength to hit it out. And like I said, there's also the matter of where you play after games in your home park. Because if you play in Baltimore, it's easier to do this.
Well, so, I mean, all right, I got to maybe push back a little bit on the ballpark issue, because, I mean, players change teams all the time. So,
sure.
I mean, is it a matter of like, well, I got traded to Cincinnati, so maybe I need to start thinking about this maybe a little bit more, but then a year later, I'm playing in San Francisco, so all of that hard work just kind of goes to waste. Like, what's
But I mean, that leads to an interesting point of like, okay, let's say somebody starts doing this and their current home park is Cincinnati, but then they get traded to San Francisco. All of a sudden, their offense craters, right?
Sure, but then couldn't you just make that argument for any player potentially moving from one location to another? Like, power just doesn't play in AT&T Park the way it does in Yankee Stadium. So is a power hitter just automatically doomed if they become a Giant?
No, of course not. Like, of course not, but I mean, I guess my thing is that, like, And I give Yonder Alonso credit for doing this in Oakland, right?
Yeah.
So it's very complicated, I guess, is my point. And I think that the discourse on it has definitely been a little, I mean, I don't want to say overblown, because, like, we've definitely seen people do this and do it well. But I just don't think it's for everybody. And I think that it might have been sort of thrown out there as if it's the solution. Not to disparage people who are writing on the subject with frequency. I don't know. I think you need to do it in the right way.
Well, all right, let's pivot to some things that Joey Votto has said in public recently. Like, he gave kind of a famous quote that I think backs up your point, where he says, you know, if the wrong guys start tinkering with their swings in order to try and get more balls in the air, they're going to screw themselves up. But then it almost seemed as though he, like, walked back, maybe not consciously, but it almost seemed like he walked back that idea a little bit. He gave some quotes to Travis Sawchuk in Fangraphs where he seems to kind of buy into the idea a little bit more. And Votto himself has increased his air ball rate, so to speak.
Right, but he's Joey Votto. You know what I mean? Like, he has natural power to begin with, and he is brilliant at manipulating his bat. Like, Joey Votto is the outlier of almost everything in hitting to the 99th percentile. He is that talented and physically gifted. Not everybody's Joey Votto.
Right. And yet here Votto says, quote, you know, consensus among all the hitters I've spoken to and hitting people I've spoken to is ground balls are bad, fly balls are good, line drives are good. Later on, he says, I could see hitters in general evolving into more of a fly ball hunting type group. And one of his main points is not just the fact that, like, air balls get you, you know, get your hits into the outfield, therefore leading to more doubles and home runs potentially, but they also beat the shift, you know?
Right, yeah.
When you're hitting the ball over the shift, you're not grounding into it. And that might also be a big driver in all of this. And, like, you know, to bring up your Ben Revere point again, like, Ben Revere is, you know, if he continues to not change his swing, Ben Revere is still going to be Ben Revere. So, like, Ben Revere could maybe stand to get the ball in the air more, maybe not to hit flies, but at least try and get, you know, a 10 to 15 degree range of launch angles rather than a 3 to 6 degree range or whatever he might be, you know?
Right.
So, like, there still needs to,
yeah. I think this leads into what I was thinking of saying earlier before we started recording, which is that you don't have to hit a fly ball to not hit a ground ball. Like line drives are a thing and they're good. They're high probability hits. I don't know if this is ever going to happen, but it would be wonderful to try and find like some sort of hitting savant who can, with regularity, shoot line drives into the gaps and then like master the art of hitting bloopers. You know, like the shallow fly balls that are too far out for the infielders, too shallow for the outfielders. Like someone who can reliably hit into that magic zone between the infield and the outfield, where like those are like insanely high probability hits because people just don't get to those balls. Like if you can hit bloopers, if you can hit line drives through the infield into the gaps, you're gonna get your hits. You're gonna be Tony Gwynn basically. And again, that's another humongous outlier, but you know what I mean. It's hard to hit, and I don't know. I think that like putting the ball in the air is good, but you don't have to hit like a fly ball if you don't have the power to reliably hit the ball out of the park by just increasing your angle.
I think the other thing that maybe like concerns me a little bit, and Votto also speaks to this, is the idea that all of a sudden if we're already in like the backlash cycle when it comes to line angle, that it's going to prevent hitters who could benefit in some degree in some way from tinkering with their swings, going to prevent them from doing it. I mean, baseball players historically are a glacial population when it comes to change. And, you know, as Votto says, like the reason that he can experiment with launch angle, the reason Josh Donaldson can experiment with launch angle in their swing planes is because they're not worried about losing a job, and they already right. and they've gotten paid. And so a guy who might be able to benefit from experimenting, and then it doesn't go well, but it's only not going well because it's a small sample size and it's early in the season, he might abandon those changes and go back to being, you know, a high contact, slap happy guy who's running an 82 WRC plus and he's not playing a premium position, and all of a sudden he's back in AAA. If the vocal contingent of people saying, actually, this is damaging to hitters, if that becomes loud enough, I just wonder if the risk of guys being willing to try things, to try shit out, diminishes. I don't know if that's true, but I'm speculating here. But I, as someone who chafes at intellectual stagnation generally, I wonder if, like, because we can get so loud and preachy from the other side of the spectrum, that it can have deleterious effects as well.
No, and that's definitely worth mentioning. This is probably one of those things that, like, and it's hard to do these things on the fly, right? Because like if you're doing it in season, like the at bats you're having, like, they matter. Like, you need to win games. So I mean, it's one of those things that, like, I could see some guys like trying out again over the off season. But there's only so much you can do in the cage and in winter ball, and it really comes into play when you face big league pitching. So yeah, I mean, that's definitely something to consider. This is something for people in the minors, maybe. But I don't know. It's very interesting, and I think that it needs to be done in the proper manner, I guess, is my larger point.
Let's pivot to our next question, which I believe has something to do with the wild card standings. Is that right, Nick?
Yes. So this is from my good friend Steven. He is at The Gray King on Twitter. Go follow him. He's fun. Why is it the farthest team from an AL wildcard spot is back 5.5 games? And this is from yesterday, by the way. So I have the standings up now, so I don't know if this is exactly true, but it was true yesterday. Why is it the farthest team from an AL wildcard spot is back 5.5 games, or the closest team to an AL wildcard spot is back 5 games?
So looking at the updated wildcard standings, so Oakland currently sports the worst record in the American League, and they are 5.5 games back of the second wild card spot. In the National League, the Phillies are in last place. They are 12 games back, and
he's a Phillies fan, by the way. That's why. He's
yeah. To the question's point, the Cubs and the Brewers are tied for closest to the wild card standings, and they are both 3.5 games back.
And that's because they're tied first place in the Central, by the way.
Yeah. So the closest teams to that position would be the Rangers and the Whites, basically the Mariners and the Rangers in the American League, and they're toward the bottom of the American League standings. I mean, I guess the easiest answer is that American League is just a better league.
And yeah, the natural everybody sucks.
And that generally is accepted, that it's just a much more competitive league, and therefore the spread of talent is a lot smaller. And I think that basically seems basically true this year. You know, there are just many more teams that are undergoing complete rebuilds in the NL, including in varying degrees the Padres, the Phillies, the Reds, the Brewers. There are just a bunch more weaker teams to beat up on. So, you know, the spread of talent is a lot wider.
Yeah, and it's also worth noting that, I mean, again, this is part because it's easy for good teams to feed on the bad teams in the National League, but you can pretty much say, from a raw, don't look at the standings, like, close your eyes and think of good teams perspective, three of the four or so best teams in the baseball might play in the National League in the Dodgers, the Rockies, and the Nationals.
Right.
And, like, it's up for debate whether or not people will go back and forth on the Rockies, whether or not they are hashtag real, but I personally buy the Rockies. And the American League, like, there's definitely some good teams. Like, obviously Houston is the best team in baseball, and they're going to just win 110 games this year probably. And there's also the Yankees, depending on how you feel about them. You can wait for Cleveland and Boston to wake up potentially. The Twins are still in first place. Holy crap.
I know, that's crazy to me. I should also clarify, actually, the Cubs and the Brewers are technically tied for first place in the NL Central, so the first team in the wild card is St. Louis, and they're 6 games back. So that's a little closer to Steven's point. But yeah, sure. No, there is greater strength at the top in the NL. I think that's a very fair point. You could probably throw, like, if the Cubs can figure their crap out, you could probably throw the Cubs into the mix of that conversation as well.
Which segs into our next question.
Yes.
From the great Ryan Watt of, you know, every outlet. what is the worst?
And a former guest.
A former guest, friend of the show, Ryan Watt. What is the worst you can imagine the coach finishing the season? So I told Ryan on Twitter, this feels like a trap for people to yell at us.
It's true. I mean, I think the worst I can expect from them is second place in the Central and they miss out on a wild card.
Yeah, that sounds about right.
But I guess that's not technically the worst. That's just kind of like the bad outcome with the highest probability. I guess the worst would be, I don't know, third place, and the Brewers finished above them, and the Cubs finished, like, under 500 or something.
Yeah, so this in part depends on how you feel about the Brewers.
Right.
Which is an interesting question, because I don't know how I feel about the Brewers just yet. Like if you want to go into, like, playoff odds and stuff on Fangraphs, like, they're not – like, the Cubs are still like a much higher odds of winning the division and making the playoffs, because the Brewers – I mean, they're the Brewers. Like they weren't supposed to be good this year.
I know. We don't even really need to provide analysis. We should just be able to say they're the Brewers.
But on the other hand, they're the Brewers, and they have all these weird, interesting players. Like, Eric Thames is good. Like, there's the Keon Broxton phenomenon of people who like Keon Broxton. Manny Pena is a 30-year-old rookie and kicking the crap out of the ball. Or not a rookie, but is he a rookie? I forget. But, like, he's, you know, he's 30 and he's kicking the crap out of the ball. Jimmy Nelson is figuring it out. You know, Hernan Perez is interesting. Like there's some like Eric Sogard's hitting home runs. Corey Knebel's fun. Travis Shaw is destroying the ball. Chase Anderson is figuring it out a little bit. So
yeah, like, by some arguments, Corey Knebel might be one of the best relievers in major leagues this year so far.
Yeah, I mean, like, there's like, one word is the walk rate. I mean, he was good last year. That's the thing. Like, he was good as a setup man last year. He had like a little bit of prospect pedigree as a reliever, but again, Travis Shaw is destroying the ball. Eric Thames came over from Korea and is killing it. Keon Broxton, who was never really a prospect. Jesus Aguilar was a waiver claim and a career AAA player and is a good platoon first baseman. I mean, it's strange and different.
But again,
one thing with the Brewers is their bullpen is crap outside of Knebel. Right. As Travis will tell you, the rotation is uninspiring to say the least. And they are currently writing some magic in their lineup. So it's really just a matter of how long they can keep it up, and the math will tell you it's not very likely to keep it up for much longer.
Right.
But it's one of those okay, but stranger things have happened.
Things. Yeah, and I don't know.
If the Cubs weren't like tripping over themselves right now, this wouldn't even be a question.
Right.
Of whether or not the Brewers are competitive.
Yeah, and we've talked about the Cubs' weird weaknesses before. But even, like, you know, like you start peeling back some of the layers on the Brewers, and like, yeah, Eric Thames probably wasn't going to be carrying over 200 WRC plus for the whole season. But it's interesting to note, like, the contact is down, the strikeouts are up a little bit on him. You know, the BABIP is coming back to earth. So, like,
he's still... I think that's just, like, the book getting out on him. Like, he might rebound from that.
Right, but... you know, where you just then have to wait on kind of like see if he can adjust to the adjustments. But it just shows that, you know, they're riding the hot hand in the first couple of months. But in terms of overall quality, I'm not too certain. But then again, you know, the Cubs are having their issues, and you know, the wins in April and May count at the end of the year. So if you bank enough now, you might be able to keep yourself in the running. I mean, that's what's the funny thing about – everybody remembers the Giants' second-half collapse last year, but they also forget that they had the best record in the majors in the first half. So they were still able to get to the wild card game, which they beat the Mets in, and they got to the NLDS. So, you know, I'm not saying that that's going to be the case for the Brewers, but the tables are going to have to turn pretty soon in order for them to fall off the table. But that's got to be, I mean, the absolute worst case is Cubs are under 500 and they finish below Milwaukee in the NL Central.
Yeah, I'm going to agree with you there because, the Central is just a weird division right now.
So weird.
Even outside of the Cubs, it's just weird.
Yeah. What the hell are the Cardinals? I don't know.
What are the Reds? I mean, like, it's strange. So here's my, you know, realistic nightmare scenario for the Cubs here.
Mm-hmm.
Schwarber doesn't put it together.
Yep.
You know, like
Arrieta continues to
struggle. John Lackey never gets hurt, but he still sucks. Eddie Butler is, you know, God, Eddie Butler's in the rotation. That's because Brad Anderson's on the DL. Shocker. Mm-hmm. You know, they really need to put Montgomery in the rotation. I don't know what they're doing there. Ben Zobrist continues to struggle and has pain hitting right-handed because of that weird injury he's got. Contreras keeps his WRC plus under 100. Bryant is good, but not like MVP level good.
Which would be fine if everyone else was backing him up.
Right, exactly. I think they kind of expected that when they signed Zobrist because, you know, he's 36. The bullpen stays strange-ish. Basically, like, things continue as is, and then somebody gets hurt. You know what I mean?
Right.
We talked about this a little bit at the beginning of the year whenever we talked to the Cubs last, but, like, the well's kind of dry right now. Like, they used to be able to just, okay, we'll call up our next super prospect, and they don't really have that anymore.
Well, they kind of did that with Ian Happ, but Ian Happ,
But, like, that was it.
Right, and he exploded, and then, you know, did what every rookie does, and he slows down a little bit, and so you don't know exactly how he's going to pan out for the rest of the year. Plus, center field isn't necessarily his most natural position, but that's where they got to play him. So, yeah, I think you're right. Like, you know, this bevy of position player prospects that they wanted to build their legacy on, they're all major leaguers now. So this is it.
Yeah, I mean, like, obviously they have the currency to make a trade, which they're going to do at some point. Like, if this continues, I mean, even if it doesn't continue, if they get better, they'll make a trade. So I don't know. Maybe Yu Darvish winds up here, but I don't know.
Yeah, it's, you know, Cubs fans, you should be sweating.
Yeah, I would say it's officially sweat time. Like that is now. That's a thing now.
All right, so I think our last question deals with another team whose fan base knows how to sweat because they do it a lot.
Okay, from, I believe this is the Mets question you're referring to?
Uh-huh.
Okay, so at Kurt1124, I don't know Kurt, but he asks, does Sandy Alderson get a pass by analytics community? Which I think is a very interesting question.
It's a very interesting question because obviously Sandy Alderson is the godfather of front office executives who embraced analytics very early on. I mean, that's how he helped to build the A's in the 80s, who played in three straight World Series and won one of them, and also was the guy who mentored Billy Beane. So he has a very important place kind of in the history of this intellectual movement. But his tenure with the New York Mets is a little strange, to put it lightly, especially for someone I think who is generally considered to be thoughtful and intelligent and usually someone who is going to make, if not always the right decisions, attempt to make the most optimal decisions for his team. We all know what problems exist within the Mets organization. We've talked about them at length on the show.
We've never talked about that on the show before.
Yeah, right. And you've written about it at length. So, but placing Alderson kind of in that swirling morass is a little difficult for me. I think the usual culprits are the owners, the Wilpon family, and Terry Collins. And also potentially the medical staff. In exactly how or in what way, we're not exactly sure.
We're not going to get into conspiracy theories here,
for you, like, where does Alderson fit into all this? Because I don't know.
Yeah, like, it's hard for me to condemn him, like, out of hand because of all the stuff that's going on there. Like, it's a very complicated situation in Queens. Because as you mentioned, there's the matter of ownership and the manager and you know, whatever curse is on them. So on one hand, like, the Mets didn't make any changes to their roster over the winter. Like, they didn't sign any free agents from an outside team or make a trade for their major league roster. So they went into the season with the same team, which is generally not what you want to do when you overperform like the Mets did a little bit last year, and you've got a pitching staff that's very fragile, but that's neither here nor there. But I don't know if that's all Sandy's fault. I can't say it is, because like the Wilpons, like, they're the ones who have to spend the money, and like we know what the Wilpons feel about spending money. So I mean he's kind of hamstrung. On one hand, like, the blame falls at his feet because he's the general manager, but also ownership has a say in this, and we know the Wilpons to be rather hands-on in these sorts of things. So I don't know if, like, I can, like, rake him over the coals for this, because I don't know how much sway he has with ownership in terms of saying, okay, guys, we really need to do this. Or, like a no more crap. Like, this has to get done. We need to make this trade and sign this guy. And I don't know. I can't speak to the relationship between Sandy and ownership.
And the,
But
that, I mean,
the
thing that I think baffles me the most is, so, you know, Alderson famously took the job more or less as a favor to Bud Selig because the Wilpons were drowning in Bernie Madoff, you know, lost money thanks to the Bernie Madoff scandal. They fired the Omar Vizquel, I think was the name of the
Omar Minaya.
Omar Minaya.
Omar Vizquel, you know, is a player.
Right, sorry. Omar Minaya left the job, and the Mets were like, if Major League Baseball worked like European soccer,
they were going to get relegated.
Well, not only that, but they would have more or less, the team would have more or less gone into receivership, you know, some
for the fans at home who don't know what that is.
They would have lost so much money and would have been so in such organizational shambles that the team more or less would go into bankruptcy and an outside organization would have to take it over until they could find a new ownership group. Alderson stepping in as the GM, which he hadn't been in that position in more than 10 years. I believe he leaves the Oakland job in 97 or 98. And had, you know, was clearly working his way toward retirement. Is like, there is such a level of stress that is now in Sandy Alderson's life that didn't have to be there before. And he's not a young man. He's, you know, pushing 70 if he hasn't crossed that threshold already. What's keeping him there? Because if he doesn't have complete control over personnel decisions, and it doesn't seem like he does, and the Mets are in much better financial shape and are much more stable than they were 6 years ago.
And better than they'd like to admit, by the way.
And what's that?
And probably better than they would like to admit.
Yeah, exactly. So given that all of those things are in place, like, why keep doing this to yourself? Like, go retire and enjoy life with your grandchildren. Like, this seems like the most thankless job in baseball, to be the GM of the Mets. And so for a guy with the stature and the pedigree of Sandy Alderson continuing to stick it out is just so confusing and strange.
I mean, I can't say I blame him because, like, the pieces were and to a degree are still there. Like, he saw the pitching coming up in the system. He saw what he got in the Syndergaard trade. He saw Matt Harvey. He saw what was happening with DeGrom and Mats and those guys. Like, and then he got to the World Series. Like, he for all, like, the crap that the Mets go through, he did bring them from, you know, they were still a travesty when they got to the World Series in a way because of the Mets. But, like, they went to the World Series. They've been in the playoffs. Like, it's attainable if things go right. And it's attainable if ownership lets them do what they have to do. But, like, I can't say I blame him because he could win a World Series there. They have the talent and they have the raw stuff. And, like, let's not forget, like, the Mets are, like, done and gone forever. Like, they still have Amed Rosario who's about to come up. And so, like, they still have the pitching. And, like I said, they have capital now. I would think that he's there because he wants to win the World Series, and I can't say I blame him for that, because as thankless as the position is from a PR standpoint and from a work environment standpoint, like, from a raw player asset perspective and from a, you know, like, the market they operate in a vacuum, the Mets job is one of the more desirable positions in baseball. Because of who they have and the market they play in and all that.
I mean, I guess that's true. I just know that if I were 70 years old and had already won a World Series, this just wouldn't feel like it'd be worth it, you know? And by the way, I just want to clarify, the official term for British soccer teams who go bankrupt is administration. They go into administration. And that's what would be happening to the Mets or would have happened to the Mets several years ago if such a system were in place here. I mean, best of luck to Sandy. He has no more hair to go gray, so he doesn't need to worry about that. Do we have, I believe we might have like one final question, Nick, maybe the most important question.
Okay. So the most important question of all, well, we have two very important questions, but we'll start with the more important question one.
Good.
Which is Paul Swiden asks, quote, why is Evan more handsome than you?
And by you, he means you, Nick.
Yes.
Well, it's, I mean, I think it's debatable if I am more handsome than you. I think I put more work into my hair. But I think that's the only thing that I really have a leg up on in the grand scheme of things.
I guess. Paul, you're dead to me. That's fine. And then my former boss, Kevin Ruprecht, who used to run things here at BTBS, asked, quote, what is Box? What is Box, Evan?
Well, given the lack of a definite article in that statement.
And given that this is a family show.
It can open things up to myriad interpretations. I mean, the first thing that I was thinking of is just because the NBA finals are going on it's a way to defend your position on the court in a basketball game, boxing out a player.
I was under the impression that it's a receptacle that you place your evil statistics into and then make it hard to understand things. But that was just what I was told.
Oh, gotcha. Gotcha.
Yes. Hi, Jonathan.
Boy, is that a deep reference. I think that's going to do it for this week's edition of In Play Podcast. These were great questions. I hope that this was a worthwhile listen for you. It was certainly enjoyable for us to answer them. And
if you're still listening, depending on when you're listening to this, there might be an article that may or may not be up at Beyond the Box Score by the great Mary Craig about some bullcrap that happens in sports every now and then. I would encourage you to go check it out.
Yes, and be sure to read all of our writing over at beyondtheboxscore.com. You can read Nick's work at Fangraphs as well. You can check me out over at FanRag Sports. Follow us at Evan Davis Sports, at Stellini Tweets. Follow the show at In Play Podcast. Subscribe to us, rate us, review us on iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts. And please send in more questions to inplaypodcast@gmail.com or tweet at any of our handles. We will be sure to answer them. I had a lot of fun, Nick. Did you have a lot of fun this week?
I did have a lot of fun. Send us more questions. Send us more fun questions. Send us more serious questions. Send us goofy questions.
Yeah, the goofy ones are the best ones.
I like goofy questions.
For our producer, Sean Brody, for our associate producer, Jen Mac Ramos, and for our theme music composers, Trapdoor Social, I am Evan Davis. Thank you so much for listening. We will talk to you next week.
I see your silhouette tonight. Everywhere I turn, I know that I am haunted, but hold on to the curse. Jumping through the screen tonight, take you in my hands. It's everything I wanted, nothing I can stand. I can't go back because I've seen the way the sun can fall down. You gotta feel it up for sunshine. Gotta make up your mind and get on with your life. You gotta fill it up with sunshine. You gotta make up your mind.
The music for In Play Podcast has been provided by Trapdoor Social. Their self-titled album is available now. Find them at Trapdoor Social on Facebook and Twitter and at trapdoorsocial.com.
I see you in the crowd tonight. Blood pools in my head. I should feel much closer now. The distance grows instead. Your words are like a symphony. You're reaching for my soul. A melody that turns and soars and always